it's time for the chip race.
Hello and welcome to the Chip Race, now bankrolled by Unibet Poker. I'm your host, David Lappin, and here with me, I'm fortunate to have Unibet Ambassador Darragh O'Kearney and contractually obliged to have Unibet Ambassador Ian Simpson. On tonight's show, Darragh and I have a great chat with Poker Stars pro and vlog star Jay Cody. We also chat to microgaming marketing manager Clodagh Hansen about the upcoming MPN on my home turf in Malta. Espen Jorstad joins Darragh in Strategy Corner to discuss bet sizing. But first, sportifying poker. Poker has historically been promoted in one of two ways, as a form of gambling and as a sporting endeavour. In the last couple of years, the latter narrative has been pushed harder by those at the top. So which is it, Darragh?
I think it's probably both. Poker is a very unusual mix of both gambling and sort of a competitive skill game, let's say. But if you were going to sell one over the other, I actually think the gambling aspect is an easier sell. Like when I came out of running into poker, my former running sports friends, let's say, found it very difficult to accept poker as a sport. They saw it just as gambling.
Yeah, it obviously is gambling, and, you know, albeit a skill-based version of it, people are ultimately risking their own money. That was the thing that drew me to poker initially when I watched it on TV. It seemed kind of cool to watch guys who, you know, okay, they were in smoky rooms. It was the old Channel 4 set on late night poker. But there was something very enthralling about the idea that these guys could win money off each other by outwitting each other.
Yeah, I think that is central to the appeal of poker. A lot of the impetus that's come recently to try and sportify poker, as they're calling it, has come from Alex Dreyfus with his GPI and Global Poker League. And one of the criticisms that has been leveled at that is that in the GPL, they're not really playing for money. I mean, that they're compensated for playing, but they're not playing for big money. If you look back historically, what people are most interested in watching on TV when poker's on is basically people playing for big money. And that's why, like, you know, the World Series of Poker main event, that's the most watched poker event every year. And outside of that, there's a big interest in the super high rollers because the amount of money involved is a lot. But if you take an event where there's very little at stake, then it's very hard to get people interested.
Yeah, actually, I remember Doug Polk in one of his poker videos referring to, you know, it almost as play chips, that these guys were, you know, I think they were on an hourly rate. And they were essentially playing for, you know, maybe there was a first prize way down the line if they became the best team. But day to day, when you were tuning in to watch on Twitch, they were actually playing for no amount of money. And that in itself just sort of removes one of the most interesting and fascinating and exciting things that exists in poker.
Yeah, I think the essence of poker is that it has to be for money. I mean, a few years ago, I think around 2013, I went to what was called the European Nations Championships as part of the Irish team. And the Irish team ended up winning, but there was very little excitement or media coverage afterwards, even though we had some of the best players in Europe playing for their countries, because effectively we were playing for no money. And we were joking that one of the guys on the team, Big Mick, who got the player of the tournament, that he was now the European play money champion. And that's basically the issue. If there's not a lot of money involved in poker, then it's basically play money poker.
Well, what is the alternative for poker sites and those at the top of the game who want to promote the game? Obviously, it's in our interest as poker pros and people who work in the industry to see the game grow and see the next generation of poker player come through. What's the trick for those guys now? If they can't make it a sport, how can they sell the game?
Yeah, I feel like some of the incentive, let's say, to sportify poker has come from, you know, governments, if they view poker as gambling, are more likely to legislate against it as a social vice or whatever. And so that's where some of that motivation has come from. But I think you have to embrace the fact that poker is gambling, and that's central to the appeal. But much more important than that poker is actually fun. It's meant to be fun. It's not necessarily the same as watching, you know, the Olympics or Wimbledon tennis when that's on. It's a fun activity that everybody can get involved in.
Yeah, and I think central to that is the idea that in a sport you generally only see the best players playing the other best players. That's the idea. I guess that's the idea of the GPL, was to put elite players against one another. One of the beauties of poker, and one of the reasons I think we probably got into it, was that notion that you could play against your hero. If you got drawn on the same table as him in a tournament, okay, you put up your 1K or 5K for an EPT or whatever, and there across from you was a Phil Helmut, say, or a Daniel Legrand, who's someone big in the game, and now you've got to pit your wits against them. Now, okay, you might be a dog in the long run, but that's an exciting challenge for you.
Yeah, I see that in Vegas every year, in particular at the World Series. You know, when the big name players like Negreanu and Helmut show up, everybody's excited, and if they're at the same table, people are thrilled. It's basically a once in a lifetime experience for them. They can go home and say that they played with one of the best players in the world in the endeavor that they're interested in. Whereas if you're a tennis player, you're never going to get to play against Federer or Nadal. But if you're a poker player, you have the chance to play against anybody.
Yeah, so bring the fun back to poker. Remind people that it is gambling, because maybe playing for money is not so bad, as long as, you know, everyone's an adult. They know what they're doing. They know the risks when they get into it. And maybe there's a different route to promoting this great game of ours. We're joined now by Clodagh Hansen, Microgaming's Product Marketing Manager for Network Games. Clodagh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I know you started off in Paddy Power. That was the first time I ever met you. I think was at one of the Irish Opens. They seem like quite a fun company to work for and to get your start in. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. I started originally in customer service for Paddy Power, working nights. And they supported me usually when I was doing my degree and gave me a shot at a temporary position in poker and eventually made that position permanent. And I definitely had a lot of fun there and I learned a lot.
Well, I first met you, I remember, I think it was Dara. I think we actually mentioned it on a previous episode of this show. Dara said something about getting me into the commentary box for the first time and it being seen as a bit risky. I think it was, in fact, your arm he twisted to get me there.
My arm needs very little twisting. I think it's great to get lots of different types of people into the commentary box. And, you know, like if it's not working out, then, you know, you can try segue out of it. And if it's working out, then great, and you can keep going with it. But I think it's always worth the risk. So I don't think there was much arm twisting.
I think Claude has been incredibly diplomatic there. I think she's gained great skills of diplomacy over her years in the corporate world. And Claude, a lot of the people I know who work in the poker industry are kind of ex-players, or that, you know, that's why they got into poker, because they were interested. Was it deliberate for you to get into poker, or did it just happen by accident?
No, it very much happened by accident. So I was kind of drifting around through jobs after school and got a job at the height of the boom for an American-facing company doing customer support for them, and got that off the basis of no experience being necessary, and all I had to do was an aptitude test. I don't think I'd even ever placed a bet in my life, and I'd never played poker before. So I was working there for about a year before things with America went a bit sour and I got laid off. So the job with Paddy Power doing customer service came up, and it was very, very poker focused, and I didn't really know poker. So I thought, as naive as I was, that I'd need to learn it before I went into the interview so I could bluff my way through it. So in the car, outside my interview, sitting in the car, learning the hand rankings, like that would ever come up in an interview. But, you know, I was 22 and I didn't really know what I was doing. So I thought I'd start there. And I managed to bluff them sufficiently into thinking that I actually knew what I was talking about and got the job, and then started playing poker because a lot of my colleagues played, and so we would be playing online at the same time when we were supposed to really be working or having little home games and things like that. It just kind of drifted into it.
Well, I hope you still have the hand rankings down now, because we're going to be testing you on that stuff as well here.
I'm so glad I'm sitting on my computer so I can get Google up there.
I'll get a paid job. Yeah, it's interesting you say that you got into poker by accident, because one of the things that's always come across when I've interacted with you is that you do seem very interested in poker, unlike a lot of the people who work in the industry who, you know, it's just a job for. I guess that's something that came later.
Yeah, it is. I was taking jobs in customer service because it was the best paid thing I could get with just having a leaving cert. And I didn't have any real interest in it. But when everybody was playing around me in Paddy Power, I started to get interested in it. Because at that time, that night shift customer support team, to get hired into it, you had to show some sort of like real interest and drive in poker. And in fact, a lot of people that I worked with then went on to have kind of mid-senior or senior roles in Paddy Power with poker or with Full Tilt and so on. And I just soaked it up from being around them. And I then developed a genuine interest as opposed to just bluffing to get a job interest.
And poker seems like a very male-dominated industry. What's it like being a woman in a male-dominated industry?
You know, it's been like this for me for a very, very long time, because when I first started with Paddy, I was the only girl on the night shift. And I've kind of become a bit immune to it now, but I guess in the beginning I did find it tough, because you could men kind of slag each other or the women in their team.
Really?
More than, yeah, I've heard you guys with Ian. I was a little bit. And so I think
we're much nicer to people we actually like, Clodagh, don't worry.
Oh, you, okay. I think I needed to develop a little bit of a thicker skin. I couldn't be quite as easily upset maybe as I was when I first started. But overall, I quite like it, to be honest. I like the dynamic of being the token woman. That's what I was called in Paddy Power for a while, the token woman.
Well, that sounds like a typically politically correct Paddy Power position to have taken.
Woman said it at the time, believe it or not.
Okay. Well, look, you're now in microgaming and you're well up the chain there. Can you tell us a little bit about that network?
There's a few networks that I'm looking after marketing for. So both bingo and poker. And with poker, we have the MPN network and the MPN Poker Tour. And we also have an Indian network, but what you guys would be most familiar with would be the Microgaming Poker Network, or MPN, as it's called, and it's got like 32 different sites on it at the moment.
Wow.
And those would be sportsbook-led skins, you know, names like Stan James and 32 Red and a lot of the bets and group brands and things like that.
Well, you're very good mentioning Stan James there, of course. Stan James powered by Unibet. So you're bringing back our sponsors, which is a big help to us. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. it wasn't on purpose at all.
Clodagh, your Twitter profile mentions that you're an exiled Irish girl. You're actually exiled in the Isle of Man now. I think you moved there a couple of years ago.
A little over 2 years ago.
Yeah, I remember going to your going away party here. How do you find living on the island? It's a bit of a hub for e-gaming.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's a small rock in the middle of the sea. There's 80,000 people living here, but a lot of people know each other, so I know a lot of the people in Poker Stars who are also based here. It's a really, really nice place to live, especially when you have to travel a lot, which I do. You know, when you're coming back to somewhere that's so peaceful and there's like zero crime and no traffic and things like that. And it's a great place for families, and I have a son, so... it's perfect for us.
You mentioned your son Liam there and what a good place it is from on the island. You and Liam made a literal splash, which made the news on the island there. Could you tell us more about that?
Front page news on the island. Liam, the boy who got blown into the sea. In one of the most ridiculous things that could ever happen, and always seems to happen to Hansons, he got blown into the sea off a bouncy castle. Just a freak.
Wow.
Lifted a bouncy castle that was on the promenade into the sea and took the child with us. He thankfully survived unscathed, bar some nightmares about sharks, and because a guy called Johnny saw it happen and immediately jumped over the railings and fished him out. It was pretty ridiculous and pretty scary. Oh.
Well, look, you mentioned living on an island and how one of the nice perks of that is no crime. Obviously, I'm here in Malta. Similar idea, you know, it's about the same size as the Isle of Man, or maybe even a little smaller, although the population's a lot more. You have your microgaming tour coming here quite soon.
I do, yes. It's the 27th of April until the 30th of April in Casino Malta. Very excited because I love Malta. I actually genuinely went there for a holiday a good few years ago when I worked in Paddy Power. Nobody I worked with at the time believed that I wasn't going for an interview, but I just was going there on holiday. It's such a pretty place, and I find the people really relaxed and friendly and easygoing, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and great choice of casino there, the Casino Malta, obviously attached to the Intercontinental Hotel there, very fancy hotel right there in the heart of Patchaville. That's a bit of a nightlife spot for anyone wanting to come for a short holiday. I'm sure there'll be plenty of pints on the streets of Patchaville over that weekend.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And what other stops have you got planned for this year? Like, some of my favourite trips last year were MPN events. We went to some really nice places. Estonia, Tallinn was really special. Mazagan in Morocco as well. So where are you planning to go this year?
After Malta, we have Manchester in July, which, while not sounding very exotic, I'm excited about because we haven't done a UK or Ireland event since the original Dublin event that we did a couple of years ago. So I'm glad to be coming over this side of of Europe again. And then in October, we're going back to Tallinn. And Tallinn's amazing. It's such a nice city.
I'm delighted to hear you're going there. That's been on my wish list for a long time, and I was very jealous of Dara getting to go there last year.
Oh, it's really, it's so beautiful, and it's got, you know, that kind of, like, Vienna is a great city to go to, and we've done a few tournaments there, and we'll definitely go back. But like any of those types of cities, your casino is kind of like on the edge of the city, and your hotel is overlooking like an industrial park and that kind of thing. In Tallinn, you're in the city centre, you're in a fabulous hotel, and you're within walking distance of everything. And I think that makes a huge difference. You know, it's not going to make a huge difference if you end up final tabling the event and you have a really deep run, but it makes a huge difference if you're the one with the majority who busts early on and wants to see a bit of the city. So it's cool that way.
Exactly. And I think, to be fair to microgaming and yourself and the way you lay out your schedule for the year, these are lovely holiday destinations all the time, and I think you're one of the companies that are really appealing to grassroots at the moment. Obviously, other operators in the industry have sort of maybe forgotten a little bit about the recreational player, the guy who wants to play maybe a $50 satellite and try and win himself a holiday and a bigger buy-in to one he's normally used to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we get players, people don't realise, you know, they kind of undervalue the types of players who would come to a €500 event or travel for one. Like, €500 is too little money to actually travel for. But we have players coming from India for this tournament in Malta, and Canada and Panama. You know,
and that's
because they want to go to Malta, and they're excited that they get to wrap a bit of a holiday into it. Even though the expenses they've won in their package obviously won't be enough to cover their flights, they're happy to put money towards it. But they really, really want the experience of it. People, I think, at times completely forget that a lot of people just want an excuse to get away and see somewhere different, and know that even if they go by themselves, they'll have other people there that they share common interests with, and that they'll be able to make friends and enjoy themselves.
Okay, and I got to ask, to what degree do you choose the destinations of your tour based on places you'd like to go?
You know what? Not as much as you might think, because when I'm actually at the tour, I don't see very much of the outside anyway.
Are you buying this, Dara?
Yeah, I'm totally buying it. I always buy everything Clodagh says.
Good man.
And now it's Ian Simpson with the news.
Hello everybody, our man JMO, James Noonan, managed to win himself $9,500 for taking second place in the PokerStars 10k payday. That was 100k guaranteed. Very nice score. Our man Dara Davey, former newsman for the Chip Race, won $4,800. He got second place in the 32 Red Poker Escalator event. That second place from JMO there makes it very, very tight at the top three. I wonder if that's going to be enough for him to pip the UK and Ireland rankings. Kenny Hallett, he won $23,000 for a fourth place finish in the PokerStars $1,000 buy-in Sunday Grand. That's another fantastic result for him following his very good weekend last weekend. And one of our favourites, Ludovic Gaelic, managed to win $17,000. He got third place in the PokerStars Sunday Grand PLO 6 Max. Very nice result for him. On the live scene, the 888 Live Easter Edition at Aspas Casino in Stratford was won by Christoph Prigowski. He managed to win £21,000 after a three-handed deal between himself, runner-up Terry Jordan, and Cyprian Prunescu, beating a field of 303 entrants. He stopped Terry Jordan, who won 21k, from becoming the first ever two-time winner of an 888 live event in London, but I'm sure the 21k will appease Terry Jordan from that. The Millions Festival is underway at Dusk Till Dawn, with the 10k high roller having kicked off on Sunday. The main event has had a couple of day ones already for its £5,000 buy-in, with day two commencing on Thursday. Remembering there's a £6 million guarantee on that, with £1 million going to first. Lovely jubbly. Good luck to everyone playing that one. Not forgetting, there's also a 25k high roller on Friday at Dusk Till Dawn as well. Last bit of good news, or last bit of news, and it's very good news, for Absolute Poker players. The acting US State Attorney for the Southern District of New York this week announced the claims process is now open for the victims of Absolute Poker. Any thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, great news there for the Absolute Poker players. I was actually one of those myself back in, because it seems like a long time ago now, I played on Ultimate Bet and Absolute Poker. They were obviously the victim of some serious scandals over the years, or well, you say victim, some of them were perpetrated by employees of the company too, but the site sort of vanished off the map after Black Friday. Again, similar to Full Tilt, there was no money to be found, so the players were kind of left holding the can. The DOJ, I have it here actually, a bit of a follow-up on that. The DOJ has concluded that players of Absolute Poker who were unable to recover their funds from Absolute Poker are similarly situated to the eligible victims of Full Tilt Poker, in that Absolute Poker, like Full Tilt Poker, did not maintain sufficient funds to repay all of its players. Accordingly, remaining forfeited poker funds that weren't claimed by the Full Tilt people can now be used to fund claims processed by eligible Absolute Poker victims. So, bit of good news there. I'm going to be putting in a claim myself, and lots of the other players out there who maybe lost anything from small amounts to possibly quite large amounts will get their money back. Finally, of course, the Millions Festival. What a huge festival. I think someone tweeted there the other day that they feel like they've been contributing to that prize pool for the best part of the last 4 months. So finally this week, they might be able to get some of it back. I think it does feel that way. It's gone on and on and on. Amazing concept, to be fair, to Party and Dusk Till Dawn. But it is that tournament that seems to have never ended.
It's been running for months and months. I'm traveling out there tomorrow, so I'm very excited to get down there finally, because I'm one of those players who's been like flicking in $100, $500 into this prize pool. So yeah, be nice to try and resolve some of those buy-ins.
Yeah, well, someone's going to win £1 million, so I can't wait to find out who that is. Maybe this time next week we'll know,
hopefully.
What's the difference between cash games and tournaments? Well, one of the big differences is the bet sizing. You'll often find that bet sizing will be a bit bigger in cash games than it is in tournaments. Dara, you've played both formats, but you're much more used to the tournament side of things. What have you observed?
Yeah, it's fair to say I don't play a massive amount of cash, but one of the things which always jumps out at me when I play live cash is that the bet sizing, particularly pre-flop, is a lot bigger. The trend in tournaments is very much towards smaller bet sizing, but then pre-flop, it's not unusual opening for 3.5 or 4 big blinds.
And is there a strategic reason for that difference, besides, as you say, maybe just a player tendency? Is there a good tactical reason for it?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe I guess we should ask Espen, since we have the cash game expert here.
Yeah, we have Espen in the booth with us today. And Espen, from your point of view, you've transitioned the other way. You've come from a cash game background, and you're dabbling more in tournaments these days. What have you noticed?
Yeah, I guess it's more common to raise bigger in cash games, of course. Like, my standard when I play cash games online is probably like min raise the button, 2.5x everything else, and 3x the small blind, I guess. That's for open raising, of course.
And is that because your range is wider on the button and it's tighter in early position?
Yeah, it's wider, and it puts like the big blind in a bad spot because it's going to have to defend a lot, and most people get uncomfortable if they have to defend a lot of big blinds and play out of position.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I remember when people started min-raising on the button, people initially thought it was a fish play, saying, well, the big blind is always going to defend, but actually, as you say, that's not a good spot for the big blind.
Yeah, it's not a good spot, and also, like, still, there's a lot of people under-defending the big blind a lot in the online cash games, because you should be defending, like, super wide, and people fold way too much still.
Yeah, it seems like the journey in tournament poker was that people used to do the big sizings in that. Over the years, maybe from 2005 till 2010, these 3 and 4Xs became more like 2.5Xs. And then between 2010 onward, the min raise was favoured by most. These days, we're going back to a larger sizing, the 2.5, much more popular, much more in vogue again. Dara, you still min raise a lot. Why do you stick to that strategy that would be maybe considered more of a 2010, 2011 strategy and not doing what most people are doing?
Yeah, I think it's largely just that it's the game that I've been playing for so long, so I know the exact ranges in every spot. Having said that, I have been experimenting more with bigger sizings, and when you look at some high rollers, for example, the sizings seem to be getting bigger. It's not unusual to see people 3xing or 4xing in high rollers. So when the stacks are deeper, I tend to open to a larger size these days.
And Espen, when you think of the concept of like the death point of a tournament, obviously, when, you know, once you lose all your chips in a tournament, there's no coming back. That game's over for you. Whereas in a cash game, you can just reload again. How does that factor into bet sizing or the way in which, you know, every chip is a dollar?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's like my main weakness in tournaments now, that I think more from a cheap EV standpoint, that I always go for the small edges and don't think enough about preserving my tournament life. But in general, I mean, the reason people open bigger in cash game is, of course, because you're usually a lot deeper. You're like 100, maybe 200 big blinds deep. So you have like bigger SPRs and you need to raise bigger.
And Dara, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I think that's basically the main function. Also, it's a function of whether there are antes in a tournament. I think that's an important factor. When there are antes, you want to be opening more hands, and therefore, because you're 4 inches wider, you're going to have a smaller sizing. But early on in a tournament, there are no antes and the stacks are deep. So it makes perfect sense to open a larger sizing to reduce the SPR.
And for that reason, Espen, would you find the early stages of tournaments when you are deeper and perhaps there isn't an ante yet as a more comfort zone for you, being used to always having 100 or 200 big blinds in front of you?
Yeah, I guess it is. And I guess I have a bit more experience playing that deep than most of the people I face in the tournaments, because I see a lot of them making some pretty big mistakes post-flop. Most of them are really good at the pushing ranges with 20 big blinds or so, where I'm not that good at that. But yeah, post-flop, I think I should have an edge on most.
Yeah, I think pre-flop, that is the big weakness of exclusively tournament players. Post-flop, when the stacks are deep, they're likely to make very big mistakes. And to be honest, it's not that punishing in a tournament, because like the biggest mistake you can make on the first hand in a tournament is going to cost you one buy-in, even if you make an absolutely horrendous mistake. But when you're deep in a tournament, like a minor mistake in your push or calling ranges could be several buy-ins. It could be like 5-10 buy-ins, because at that stage you're playing for much more money. So I think tournament players, just the risk to reward in terms of their study, there's a much greater reward from getting the sort of end game spots right.
That's a really good way of looking at it. Yeah, I think to summarize, I think cash game guys can learn from the tournament guys, and likewise, tournament guys definitely can learn from the cash game guys.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, looking forward to getting some coaching from you tournament pros of the Unibet Ambassador team here now. Use that as a free resource. Sounds
yeah,
good.
Dara comes very expensively. I could probably do you a cheaper deal though.
Sounds good, yeah.
We're joined now by Jake Cody, probably the biggest name we've ever gotten on the show, so a huge boon for us. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jake.
What's happening, lads? How's it going?
Hi, Jake.
All right.
Jake, I know you're jet-lagged and exhausted after your trip to Hollywood for the Seminole Hard Rock WPT. In fact, you made a bit of a rookie error, I think, going to bed at the wrong time, so you're all out of whack at the moment.
It's been a crazily busy year, too. I live in London, but I've hardly been here whatsoever, and yeah, I made a huge mistake of the day I landed. I landed at 10 a.m. I think, and slept on the flight, and for some reason I thought it'd be a good idea to have what I thought would be an hour long nap at 4 p.m. which turned out to me waking up at 11 p.m. and then just now.
So have you been to sleep since?
After that, I actually went to play poker until about 5 a.m. at the Palm Beach Casino in London. The game broke about 5 a.m. I think, and then for some reason I couldn't sleep again until midday, and then went to sleep again, and then woke up at 8 p.m, a little bit better, and then stayed up again till today, and I fell asleep about 11:30 today, but then woke up at 5 p.m. today. So I'm slowly getting it back to normal. But
you call yourself a professional poker player? What the hell is this?
It's a disaster. Although it's kind of good for my because I play quite a lot of cash games in London, and the game starts like 8 p.m. through 5 a.m. So I'm actually wide awake for it. It's like I have breakfast and then go play. If I could live like this normally, it would actually be okay. But no one else is awake when I want to do things.
Well, last week on our news bit, we mentioned Ryan Reese's win in the main event, but we neglected to mention that you actually came 11th for a pretty tidy 60 grand score. Other than that, Cash, how was the trip?
It was really good. I actually built up a stack in the main two and busted. The whole thing was great, actually. I had a lot of big runners and stuff. I think any time there's poker in Florida, too, it's just so soft. It's, like, pretty damn amazing. But having said that, I was actually really sad to have missed the Irish Open, too.
Yeah, the Irish Open was pretty special this year.
Yeah, so I saw a lot of my friends posting about how good it was. Because, obviously, like, over the last couple of years, I feel like it's not lost it, but, like, it's been a bit less prestigious.
Sure. Like 2 years ago was definitely a low point, and it's coming back from that. And this year was amazing.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I mean that's like, I think it's like the longest running one, right?
Yeah, it's the oldest tournament in.
Yeah, it'd be sad to see it like fade away.
I remember reading that somewhere that you built up your role from a $10 deposit. I think. Do you mind talking us through how you originally spun that up?
I borrowed $10 off my. I gave my mum some money to deposit on in her name when I was 18, but I didn't have my bank account then.
Oh, yeah.
And basically, I just...
Is this one of those no home Jerome situations, or is this legit?
Anyway, so I used to play for a pool team, and the older lads taught me how to play pool. Taught me how to play poker. And then me and my best friend, Matt Perrins, we both from Rochdale, we live like 5 minutes from each other. We used to just go and borrow the chipset to play against heads up against each other every single day. And
cool.
Eventually found online poker, deposited, and then just was obviously didn't think I was going to do it, like even make money from it. I just like thought it was fun. And we just, you know, had no bankroll management or like game selection. I was just playing every single day. I was playing a different game and different type of game and different stakes. But obviously ran well at the start. There's a lot of free rolls on at the time, I remember.
Yeah.
And I was just playing a lot of free rolls and just like micro stakes. And then eventually had a couple of wins and then started playing a little bit bigger. And one of the big, I remember satelliting into the Sunday Major, $200 Sunday Major, and got like 11th place for like 2,500, which was like ridiculously big at the time. And that kind of kickstarted the whole thing. And then I guess started playing more and more and I don't know, higher and higher.
My second ever EPT was Deauville. I remember winning in the same...
Oh, was it?
It was, yeah. I remember winning in the same pot at the end of day one, and I think I was maybe third in chips overnight. It went pretty... It went pear-shaped early on day two, though, and I remember busting on day two and hanging around with John Eames a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because he said a friend of his was going deep.
So Eames actually, he refused the swap for me in this tournament, by the way.
Really?
So I went with Matt Perrins, Nicky Evans... I don't know if you remember him, and John Eames. And I was like, okay, boys, let's swap 5% each. And like Nicky and Pez were like, yeah, okay, booked. And Eames was like, nah, no, not swapping with you.
That sounds like Eames.
Yeah, and so I swapped 7.5% with Pez and Nicky instead.
Oh, even better. They got his share. That's even sweeter. Well, that EPT result, Jake, it was January 2010, was the first part of your famed Triple Crown. You then won the WPT in August 2010 and the Heads Up Bracelet in Vegas and 850 grand to go with it in May 2011. At only 22 years old, these results sort of propelled you, I guess, into the upper echelons, into the limelight. For someone who always seemed as reticent as you did, how did you adjust to all that attention?
To be honest, it was a bit of a whirlwind, really. It was just one of those streaks where I just had confidence, I was running well, and just everything just fell into place so perfectly. And to be honest, I don't really remember like how I really handled it. It just seemed to happen so quickly, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, you realize you're a bit more well known in poker, and like, you know, poker news were reporting on you more and stuff, and like people writing articles and things, which was cool. Like, it's like something, like, although I don't really class it as famous, it's nice to have respect in you know, something you've worked hard at.
Definitely.
Sure. Unsurprisingly, PokerStars came knocking in 2013. What was it like becoming a team pro for the biggest poker brand in the world?
Oh, amazing. I mean, especially like when I first went into poker, I mainly just played Full Tilt and Stars. So like those two for me were like the creme de la creme, like the fact that like when PokerStars finally came in, because I'd been in talks for PokerStars for a while, but they had to wait until I was 25 for like some kind of advertising reasons, I think in the UK, because it's gambling. And eventually signed, and it was like amazing. And it's like, I can't believe how long I've been there now. It's actually my fifth year this year.
Well, yeah, I didn't realize the age thing. I remember at the time wondering why you hadn't been snapped up already.
Yeah, that was the reason. Basically, I'd been in talk for a while, and
So you've been playing for 10 years, pretty much the same as both of us. Your enthusiasm for the game doesn't seem to be diminished. In fact, you said in a recent vlog you still love it. How have you kept the passion for the game?
I honestly feel so lucky that I can still do it. Like, I don't want there to be a day where it either gets too bad or it gets too tough, or, you know, for whatever reason it can't happen anymore. Just because I still just really enjoy playing the game. Like, I've been playing cash games the last 2 days. I really still love the game. I'm getting to that stage now, though, where I'm feeling like I'm transitioning to like one of the old school players now, though, where it felt like I've always been like a young gun in poker, and now I'm like, oh, there's all these kids playing these tournaments, free betting every hand.
Well, Jake, Dara just mentioned your vlog there. Look, it instantly became very popular, and I can see why. I think I've watched all the episodes myself. They are really engaging, they're honest, and I think they give a really good feel of what life is like from your perspective. You mentioned in one episode that you laboured over the first one, editing software, decisions of what to keep in and leave out, etc. That's something I think Dara and I really understand. We put a lot of time into the presentation of this show and emphasise like how the content... you know, you definitely put yourself on the line with the content you put out there. You probably feel like that kind of bit of pride and, you know, that it's on you. Given how positive the response to your vlog was, and almost immediately, how are you feeling about doing it these days?
I mean, that was great. I mean, I felt very exposed after the first one. And like you say, it's like, you might know, people who might watch them or like listen to a show like this, they probably don't even realize how much work goes in behind the scenes. And it's like, a lot of the stuff that seems so simple is just very tedious, like things where you've got to like make everything line up and be perfect. But the response just made me so motivated to do more. And it's really great. I didn't want it to come across as like a glossy, you know, production. Like I wanted like it to look like well made, but I wanted it to be more of like a raw, like real, like insight rather than like, you know, a glossy like TV show, if that makes sense.
Sure. And on one of your vlogs, you mentioned that sometimes you actually find it easier to talk to the camera than you do to talking with people. That's something I can relate to very much, because there's stuff find easier to put on my blog, for example, than I would necessarily to say to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now I'm going through a stage where I'm like trying to grow as a person, try and be less of a kid, where I've kind of just played poker as a game for a while. And I don't know, I guess there's certain issues and things that like, I'm not very good at talking to people about problems and emotions and things. Which I've become better at, but like I mentioned in the blog, it's easier sometimes just to talk when to the camera, because you kind of, even though you know people are going to see it, you're not getting instantly judged, which I guess is kind of an issue sometimes. I think, I know, especially for poker players, you kind of get locked away playing a game for a long time. You don't pick up a lot of life skills that some other people might.
Part of the skill of being a poker player is kind of deception. And kind of hiding all that stuff. So
for sure, and like, yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things I really focused on in poker was like removing emotion from like decisions, and I actually think that has a bit of a negative effect on your life too, because it means you like you feel less emotion in other parts too, which I've kind of like balanced out a bit more recently, and I've noticed I've actually took winning and losing in poker a bit more to heart too recently as well.
That's really interesting. I think that's one of the strengths of the vlog, though, having watched it. Like you mentioned that you wanted it to be like, like warts and all, or a bit more like fly in the wall, that you're seeing what's really going on in your life. But I think that confessional moment on the couch there where you said that to camera and stuff, I think it rings so true to people that, you know, really, it just enhances the quality of the content, because people no longer feel like they're watching some slick poker stars video. They're actually watching you.
That's exactly what I didn't want it to be like. Like, obviously, I love poker stars. I'm so proud to be about it. But I didn't want it to be like, you know, Jake Cody brought to you by poker stars, like as in like some like Ronaldo advert. I wanted it to be like, you know, just me and my life.
Definitely. In an interview with Lee Davey, I did a little bit of research for you coming on, Jake. An interview with Lee Davey 3 years ago, you said that fatherhood changes your outlook. I'm quoting you now, changes your outlook on what you would do if you won the next big tournament and how you would better manage your bankroll. It definitely makes you more careful and conscious. Shortly after that, you came fifth in EPT London on a final table that included our good friend Kevin Killeen. I think you won 130k sterling that time. Were you more careful with the money?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so since Ari was born, I actually I've been predominantly focusing on cash games like for the last few years. I mean, I still play tournaments, but I actually consider myself more of a cash game player these days, who plays tournaments rather than the way around, whereas in the past it's been completely on tournaments. I mean, I still love tournaments and I still think you can make a lot of money from them, but just like the variance is just so insane. And with cash games, you can have a bit more of like a steady income and feel a bit more in control of like the outcome month by month. Whereas in tournaments, they're kind of in control of you of what happens. Like you can't really decide you're going to put a lot of hours in and win. Like it's kind of, there's a lot of variance involved.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean there. What do you think, Dara? You've always been a tournament grinder like myself. The temptation of maybe the lower variance of cash ever been something you thought about?
Well, I started as a cash player, but then once I pretty much won the first big tournament that I played in, and that completely turned my head. It was just far more exciting than grinding out an hourly in cash for me. I struggled to go back as a result. Basically, I think the last cash session I played was in Vegas a couple of years ago, and that was just to keep Jason Tompkins company. And I remember saying to him afterwards that if I had to do that for a living, I'd probably prefer to go and work in McDonald's.
Really?
Yeah, I really don't enjoy cash, I have to say.
Oh, so I've actually gained quite a love of it recently, especially like super deep stack cash. I think super deep stack hold'em is like such like a more complex game.
And there's that's so many true, more decisions yeah.
that
yeah.
come up. Which I've found quite exciting, as I felt like I was stagnating as a tournament player in a way, where I'd got to a certain level where if I wanted to get a lot better, I'd have to like put in a ridiculous amount of work to gain like a tiny little edge. Like, so the difference yeah. in how much better I'll get wouldn't be that much. So I decided to put more of my focus in cash games and decided to like, I'm still working on tournaments, but not as hard as I was when I was just a tournament player.
Well, Jake, just to address the elephant in the room, I realise that our listeners may remember the blogs Darren and I wrote over the last few years about some rake hikes and some dismantling of the Supernova programme. They might also remember our criticisms from Barcelona and Prague festivals last year. I think it's important for people to realise, though, that Darren and I have a very good relationship with Stars, always have, and are, consider ourselves good friends with people in the company, people we really respect. It's never been personal for us, and it was never going to affect the type of interview we would do with you, for example. I do have one question, though, about whether other people, say other pros perhaps, have targeted you ever for criticisms or questioned you because you are the face of the company.
I probably deserve a bit more like you know, questions than I've received, to be honest. I mean, yeah, no one's really like approached me at all. I've not had any negative stuff whatsoever, and of course there's been a lot of controversial decisions that Stars have made, but I think like they're trying to look at the bigger picture, and it's like it's difficult for them because they're trying to please a lot of different groups of people. They're trying to make the most money for themselves, and obviously they don't want to upset the poker community too, and it's they've kind of been put in a lot of different directions. But one thing I can say, there's just so many great people working at PokerStars too, who are trying to do the right thing and will do for the best of the whole poker community. So I'm hoping it's going to work out.
In your vlog episode, I remember I think it was called The Biggest Pot Ever Played, you were asked, I think you were like taking questions from people who tweeted in or whatever, and I think one of the questions was, what do you think poker needs to do to increase its popularity? And you rightly pointed out that that was the question on all online sites' mind these days, that everyone was kind of, all the sites were trying to tap into that. Your answer was that the dream of being a poker pro needs to be kept alive. Bringing the old interview full circle, in a sense, you started out with 10 bucks. That was your first deposit. What do you think Stars, and I guess sites in general, are doing right now? And more importantly, what are they not doing to keep that dream alive?
So I think that is just such an amazing reason. I mean, I guess I may be slightly biased, as in my social group are mainly professional poker players, and that's how a lot of us started. But even from like back home, friends and like people who I see on social media who are just like poker fans, that's kind of why people play poker. Like, obviously there's aspects of just like playing a social game with friends, but it's like the dream of like maybe starting out small, seeing if you can get a little better, you see a few small improvements in your game, and then you're looking at like, you're always looking at higher stakes and big tournaments and like big cash games and thinking, wow, imagine like, actually at the very start it kind of seems inconceivable, but like you're kind of like impressed and excited at the people playing those stakes. And I think that drives everyone. It drives the small stakes play middle stakes, medium stakes play higher stakes. I think the dream is just super important for like poker longevity to keep alive. And what sites are doing, I think, so PokerStars have a new tour called the Mega Stacks, which is trying to tap into exactly that. It's trying to like give the like lower stakes players around the country the opportunity to play like a Stars event, and I think that's definitely a good start, as in like give players a better stepping stone to get up, rather than, you know, maybe even like a 1k event for like a UKBT or 770 is quite big for a lot of people, it's like a smaller, easier stepping stone.
Yeah, I know that you know, Darren and I are obviously affiliated with Unibet these days, but and we're very passionate about their UK tour, which is a similar attempt, I think, as the one that David Curtis and the people in PokerStars are doing, pushing the mega stacks, just to, you know, not lose touch with the grassroots and the fact that poker, I think, only works when it's a bottom to top economy. It doesn't work as a trickle down economy at all.
I completely agree. Yeah,
I agree with that too. I mean, you could see that in Ireland. For the reason why the Irish Open went off the rails a few years ago was, I think the main sponsor was kind of just interested in getting in big foreign names. They lost sight of the fact that it was the sort of small Irish club players and pub players who they needed to appeal to, and they basically priced it so much that those people couldn't even afford satellites anymore, and the event suffered. But this year you could see that, you know, with the lower buy-in, They got the most runners ever for an Irish Open, and the field was 80% Irish.
Yeah, I heard the atmosphere was amazing there.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I'm sure it was chaos when I made it. Was great.
A lot of Norwegians there too. So.
Oh God, yeah, the Norwegian Open.
Yeah.
So you have to be Norwegian to enter that, though, right?
You do, yeah. But basically, they were coexisting in the same spot in the same space, the Norwegian Championships and the Irish Open. So I mean, some of the Norwegians were in the Irish Open too.
Irish
so.
Open
I've heard it's absolute mayhem during that Norwegian thing.
Complete mayhem.
Oh, you should get yourself over next year.
I know. I was really sad to miss it, but basically, I'd just been in Panama for the championship event, and basically, I was going to see my daughter in Florida, and then that just happened to be the same week as the Florida tournament, so it made just complete sense for me just to stay there for a couple of weeks, spend some time with her, and like play those tournaments as well.
Well, finally, Jake, before we let you go, I have a few questions from Twitter. I know you sometimes field questions from Twitter on your vlog, but we managed to get some of our Twitter fans to contribute a few questions to you. So it's going to be a bit of a hit and run format. I'm just going to hit you with a few quick questions, and they're short enough answers. Firstly, Mark asks, 10-2 ended up costing Texas Dolly a lot of money after his WSOP win. Has the same happened to you with 10-4 off?
In fact, so every time I get it, like, I kind of smile to myself inside, like, thinking about how obscene it is. But actually, unless it's like a spot where, like, I'm defending 10-4 suit in the big blind or something multi-way, I very rarely play it. In fact, I can't even think of the last time I played it.
Simon asks, who are your poker idols and the people you look up to in the poker world?
Back in the day, like, my absolute hero was Phil Hellmuth. Like, I used to love his, like, blow-ups. I bought his book. Like, I literally thought he was the absolute king. And I still think he's like a massive legend now, but I wouldn't say I looked up to him in the poker world. Like, obviously I'm impressed by what he's achieved and stuff. To be honest, I'm probably most impressed by the online high stakes cash game players, just because I've been playing a lot more live cash recently. Like, people like True Tello, TB Red Baron, those guys, I think no one has put as much work in and are as good at poker as those guys.
No, I think that's fair. It's another level, isn't it?
It's a complete another level, yeah. And, like, to be honest, there's quite a few live guys in Macau too who, like, no one would even recognise their name or their face, but, like, they're just so fucking good at poker. And it's, like, it kind of doesn't annoy me in a way, but, like, I feel like it's quite distorted with the poker world on who is the best when it's not true.
Sure. John asks, what's your number one tip for noobs?
It's going to sound kind of boring, but work hard. Like, I think everyone who's become a professional poker player probably had, like, that period when they first got into poker where they were just completely obsessed, you know, wanted to just play all day, every day, and, you know, found friends who were on a similar level or higher level, you know, just talk poker with your friends, try and find any, you know, poker content online, on YouTube, on training sites, just immerse yourself in poker. And if you have that, if you have that kind of work ethic, I think anybody with a reasonable amount of intelligence can be successful in poker.
Sure. And finally, Andy asks, how often does Jake dye his beautiful ginger locks?
I've not actually done it for years now. Like, he mustn't have seen me for a while because the emo looks way, way long gone.
We always have the cap on, so maybe you just couldn't tell.
Tell.
I had the cap on because I'm kind of slightly balding at the back. That's why it's kind of tilting.
I haven't actually seen Jake with black hair in a while.
Wow. Yeah, it's been like well over 2 years.
I actually didn't realize you were the same person for a while, because you used to have the hair down over your face as well.
Yeah, a lot of people said that. Like, whoa, you used to have black hair, right? I was like, yeah. I need to win something now looking like this, so like people know.
People realize it's the same person.
Well, look, Jake, before we go, I want to give you, big time Jay Cody, an opportunity to plug yourself on Little Time, the Chip Races show. If we do have any listeners out there who, for some reason, live under a rock and don't know who Jay Cody is and don't know that you do a vlog, can you let them know where they can find it?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter, just my name, Jake Cody, and my YouTube channel is just called Jake Cody 2, all one word, super easy. I'm actually currently editing the vlog from Panama. Over the last day or so. So that should be up in the next couple of days. And got a very busy schedule coming up. I'm going to Monaco. Going to be doing some vlogs there for the PokerStars Championship. Then going to WPT Amsterdam. Going to be doing some more vlogs there. Then going to go to Macau and go and play Scoop and Cash Games. And then Vegas. Basically, been the craziest year so far. I've like not stopped one second. But it's going well. So I feel like when it's going well, you just want to play all the time. So that's where it's at right now.
Well, so much to look forward to there.
Yeah, I mean, it's hectic, but I like the chaos of it, to be honest. I like the uncertainty of what's going to happen. It kind of, I don't know, I thrive on it.
Darry, you're doing a big Vegas as well, so you'll probably catch him there.
I'm bracing myself for a big Vegas, I think is the way I describe it.
What, you don't like it?
Like, I generally only go for 3 weeks, and this time I'm going to probably go for almost the full series. I'm not a big fan of Vegas as a place, but obviously for a poker player it's amazing, and the World Series is absolutely amazing. And I always go out there full of enthusiasm for the first week or so, and then if the first week doesn't go well, you just find yourself drained.
Yeah, I mean, it can feel like you're going a little bit insane, just going to the same registration queue and playing.
I remember saying to Neil Channing once that if you ever want to see contrast, just the World Series, the people walking through the halls of the Rio in the first week of the World Series and the last week, and you won't recognize that it's the same people. You know, everybody's bouncing around in the first week full of enthusiasm, thinking this is the year we win a bracelet, and then in the last week it's like, yeah, I've lost all my money, just get me out of here.
well, look, I sincerely hope that happens to neither of you. I hope you both win bracelets this year.
That'd be good.
Jay Cody, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Playing us out tonight is a DJ and producer who blends dubstep, techno and house. He is currently working on his second studio album. This is an absolutely cracking tune from his first album entitled Fading Love. This is George Fitzgerald and Full Circle. Neustadt and Jake Cody. We're off for a few weeks on hiatus, but when we return, we will have that interview that we promised you with David Vanderhayden. We will also be sitting down with 888 Poker Ambassador, WSOP presenter and 2009 Irish Open runner-up, Cara Scott. Before we go, I want to give a shout out to the Jacks to Jokers poker clothing brand. For the month of April, they are giving 10% of their proceeds to the mental health charity Mind. I also want to thank my good friend and music promoter, Will Rolfe, who has, on my behalf, cajoled some really tremendous artists into letting us use their fantastic tunes. I'd finally like to plug my new Twitch poker stream, which will be live 3 nights a week and can be found at twitch.tv/DavidLappinStream. Our next show will be on May 23rd. Until then, from Dara, Ian, and myself, good night and good luck.